popped out when we were talking earlier. I don't know if it will lead anyone up, but you used the words rapid onset to describe your Kundalini experience.
Right.
Which was interesting to me because I hadn't heard that term until recently when in relation to gender dysphoria. There's rapid onset gender dysphoria, which I shouldn't laugh, but I can't help it. But I don't know why I'm laughing, actually, because it's really not funny, but I guess it's kind of absurd is why. But it seems absurd, but perhaps this is a context for it that would make it less absurd, which is, of course, rapid onset gender dysphoria is the... somebody who very rapidly becomes convinced that they are a different sex identity in the wrong body, right? So, it just struck me as kind of interesting that to what extent, I mean, as I was talking earlier about the cultural context in which we try and process experiences that are incomprehensible to us, how dangerous it can be, you know, to what extent might individuals who are having, I mean, like even you calling it Kundalini rising, I mean, we didn't ever really establish why you stuck, you know, landed on that term just because you needed to call it something, right? And that was the closest match. So, and it was, you know, at least there were some correlations there. You found a few. So, but, you know, if we reduced it to something much more basic, like the identity just becoming loose, you know, suddenly for unknown reasons, and our ability to focus our awareness being somehow inhibited or sabotaged, and we enter into this unfocused state in which all this unconscious material and perceptual data is coming to us, and we can't organize it as quickly as we're used to, and so we look for ways to make sense of it. To what extent might people, you know, adults or children who are conditioned through the ideology to think down certain tracks, end up reformatting their experience in order to make sense of it and saying, oh my God, I must be a man in a woman's body, or vice versa.
I think I've heard you articulate the view before that about this issue about gender dysphoria, that it could be a more general, dysphoria itself is making a certain value judgment on an experience. It's assuming that something is neurological or qualitatively similar to other unpleasant experiences that other people have had without really, you know, it sort of begs the question, I guess, you know, it assumes something. But I think I've heard you imply, or maybe state outright, that you think that maybe, or you suspect that maybe gender dysphoria is directed to gender as a focal point, and it could be caused by a lot of different things. And, you know, maybe also like an obsessive tendency that someone has to examine their life, and then that's a socially acceptable avenue to question now, which I'm not saying it should or shouldn't be, but if someone is generally dissatisfied with their life and they develop sort of a compulsion around focusing on gender, then it could be sort of socially constructed. Is that sort of one of the positions that you've taken?
Absolutely. I mean, because the fact being that gender itself simply doesn't exist. I mean, I guess I sort of knew this, but I didn't really become conscious of it until I researched the actual roots of the word gender. I mean, it just doesn't have any historical linguistic basis to it. It's just recently been thrown into the mix in the last 50 years or so, and now we just take it as a given that somehow gender exists and beyond. I mean, now it's becoming, you know, obviously that something is wrong here, because because this ideology is creating narratives that simply are self-contradictory, as in the idea of a gender or a sex that exists independently of biology or genitalia. I mean, obviously it simply doesn't make sense, but the idea of gender at all existing, you have to refer to a social construct. That was how the word began being used in a semi-meaningful sense in identity politics, was,
you know, gender roles.
Yeah, gender roles,
yeah,
gender stereotypes. So, yeah. Anyway, without going into all the woof and woof of that, you can map gender identification, gender roles and whatnot onto the identity per se, which is also a concept that is questionable. Like, it's a necessary concept. I guess gender has become a necessary one too because of the socialization of male female roles and behaviors and whatnot. Then you get this construct called gender, and because of the socialization of human beings per period, you get this notion of identity, and along with it, identity politics, identity theft, identity crisis, and so on, right? All these things that are very real within their context. But what's interesting here, I think, is that if the basis of the experience that you described, the ones that I've had, premature enlightenment, and the full meal deal that David Sharnas is talking about is actual enlightenment, relates to the loss of the illusory identity, you know, the socially constructed identity self, the trauma-generated ego, the dissolving of it. It wouldn't really be a loss, but, you know, the pushing out, the clearing, the dissolving, the transcending, whatever we're going to call it, then it seems quite likely that people who sort of undergo an experience of identity loss before they're ready and are threatened by it, like you and your cowboy, will cobble together an altar as quickly as they can in order to shore up, you know, to block the tidal wave that's coming at them through unfocused awareness. And of course there's an opportunity in that crisis, because if you're unstable to begin with, so that you're vulnerable to this kind of thing, then presumably there was some dysphoria or unhappiness there to begin with, in an unstable identity, you know, low or poor, I forget what it's called now, identity coherence or something like that, low identity coherence, something like that, poor boundaries and so on. That would be what made you vulnerable. So then in that state of liminality, the temptation to create a new identity, I mean the need to bring back your old identity, to bring back an identity, but then also the temptation, well, you know, all bets are off now, so I can be whoever I want to be. But also, I suppose that it would be part of making sense of the experience, would be trying to create a new identity, because it wouldn't make as much sense to go back to the old identity if everything is falling apart. Then the old identity would be seen as unviable, because it fell apart, right? So then there would be a natural compulsion, if that's not an oxymoron, to cobble together a new identity that will survive, you know, the disruption of whatever's happening. And so then you have the shifting of genders, because that's one obvious way to reinvent oneself drastically, beyond just buying a cowboy hat or an Indiana Jones jacket, right? Is you actually say, I'm a different sex, and of course you have all of the social, the ideological, the philosophical, the medical, financial, you have all the system, the support system is in place. So yeah, it's very interesting. Somebody just posted this or tweeted this that, you know, are they targeting people with shamanic potential in order to castrate, you know, sterilize, mutilate them, and completely, you know, neutralize them?
Was that posted on your site?
No, that was a Twitter. It was somebody tweeted it. And I haven't gone there, but I guess because I haven't. It's been a while since I thought about or wrote about the being this sort of potentially more shamanic part of the population. I mean, I don't really adhere to that model anymore, but not because I've rejected it. I just haven't found it useful in recent years, and I don't think you can map it directly onto the gender dysphoria thing, because I think a lot of it is children who are being coerced into that by their parents, and it would have nothing to do with them necessarily being, you know, more psychically open. Or but maybe it would actually, because if they're more vulnerable and they're more traumatized, they would also be more open. But anyway, this is obviously it's a very a big picture there. But I think the, you know, the basic elements that are relevant to everyone is, you know, experiencing some flexibility of the identity is a good thing, but if we experience it as instability, there's a good chance that we will double down, you know, and react in some way that tries to, you know, that overcompensates for that. And I think that society very much is largely geared towards that, with preventing that kind of awakening from happening, partially by providing these false solutions that will allow us to avoid it. Yeah.
Marketing, for instance, destabilizes the identity and then offers ready-made identities. There were a few things that you said that I thought were really compelling, and one was just, I don't remember the last time I've heard or if I've ever heard someone say gender doesn't exist. And the interesting thing, and I would agree with you personally, but the interesting thing is that that could be, if you just put that statement out there without any modifiers or follow-up, a lot of people would actually interpret that to be like a statement that endorses whatever you want to call it, gender reassignment surgery or sex change surgery or other things like alternative identities and things like that. And that's not to critique your statement. I just think that that's actually a really good critique of the whole issue, and it sort of exposes it for what it is, which is I think it's, the thin end of the wedge is questioning unhealthy, socially constructed gender roles and gender identities and things like that. And I think that that's, I don't know if you would agree with me or not, but I think that's actually a good thing. And that seems to be how this all got started. But then if you look at a lot of, I won't say all, but a lot of trans people's identities are really just, very conventional, like Bruce Jenner, Caitlyn Jenner. Not that I keep up with that a whole lot, but it's like very conventional gender roles being adopted by people who formerly identified as male. And so it's really just like a almost like a hyper traditionalist way of navigating gender under the auspices of being, radical or transformative somehow. And so that's something that stuck out to me, is that a lot of these people don't really, and they also assume, they don't really question the validity of gender as something that exists or doesn't exist. And that seems to be, that's why I thought that your critique, in just summed up in that one sentence, was so effective. But also the way that people treat gender is really as though it is something that exists, even though you can't measure it or really demonstrate it. You just have to take people's word for it, and it exists as something that's like, almost like a soul or something. It's like, it's just there, and maybe you're born with it, maybe you're not. But as a part of your identity, apparently. It's just this authentic form of your identity that no one but you can see. And that's why I liked, just to tie it back to, you were talking earlier about identity being something that forms in response to hypersocialization, and we use the asylum or the mental institution as an example of, you know, at the opposite end of a polarity with wilderness. And I do think that people, like, in school now are hypersocialized in a way that's really unhealthy. I like that term too. I've never heard you use it, but I've heard you imply similar things about socialization. But I think I just thought it was a really interesting connection to, at the very beginning of our conversation, when we were talking about the wilderness versus the institution, as being something that, you know, maybe one allows for the full spectrum awareness, and one tends to encourage an ever narrower and less healthy identity. And I think I wasn't sure if you intentionally drew that parallel between some of the trans ideology or not, but I thought that was a really interesting thing that you kind of pointed out there.
Yeah, it was kind of new to me as well. I mean, I've also obviously heard the term institutionalized before in the way that you used it, but it's occurred to me in the course of this conversation that one could use it as a synonym for hypersocialized or over-socialized, that people become institutionalized through over-reliance on institutions to tell them who they are. And it was partly because of what you describe as your experience in the asylum, because that seemed counterintuitive, that I think I would have thought or assumed that being in an institution, I mean, not counting all the drugs, of course, which do blot out your sense of coherence or reality, but leaving that aside, that I would have thought of being in an institution like that would reinforce a sense of identity, because you would have to be so defended. But what you described was that you found it like the constant monitoring and observation and evaluation that was going on caused your sense of who you were to somehow withdraw, or what? I mean, you didn't fully describe it, so what would you say was happening there?
Well, I actually didn't. I didn't take the drugs. I was given one drug that I responded to really badly, so things got off to a real. I mean, I had essentially like a sensitivity allergic type of response to it, and was kind of unable to control the muscles of my tongue and throat, and felt like I was choking. And I learned later that a lot of people actually die from this reaction when they have it, so I was lucky because I didn't get any attention for it. But the experience was, I've heard you describe trauma before as something that just completely overwhelms the organism. And so by that definition, I would say that it was just the most traumatic aspect of being there was the sleep deprivation, because I'm used to sleeping in a really dark room and, you know, having a quiet setting to sleep in and that kind of thing. And I don't think the lights ever fully went off there, and someone would literally walk by and open the door like every 15 minutes, not very quietly sometimes. Hmm. So it was just, you know, I was already in a little bit of a compromised state just because I've been so animated before going in there. And so I, you know, I definitely really needed rest and to recuperate physically, and just being there really kind of ground down my body in a way that, it was really traumatic overall. And so, you know, there was definitely some dissociation going on, because it's difficult for me sometimes, if I think about a few events that I know occurred in there, it's really difficult to determine what order they occurred in, that kind of thing.
Right, so that's what you're describing there with the sleep deprivation. Was that intentional, by the way, do you think, or was it just apparent a side effect of their just constantly monitoring everything?
I wonder. I do wonder if sometimes the people that make—I mean, all it would take to count it as intentional would be one person that makes the policy, looking and saying like, "Well, we could make more profit if people recover a little bit slower, and if we change the check-ins from every 2 hours to every hour to every 15 minutes, then they'll recover a little slower." I mean, I can't know for sure, but I mean, I do think that it's a little bit ridiculous because I didn't check in with any suicidal ideations or risk of suicide or anything like that. And that was the reason that was given why they would do that every 15 minutes on every patient there. So,
Were you in a dorm though, or were you sleeping separately?
sleeping separately, we each had a room.
Wow. And they wouldn't let you sleep in the dark, and they wouldn't let you sleep unobserved for more than 15 minutes.
And one of the symptoms or one of the issues that I had for like months after I got out was a lot of nights I would wake up every 15 minutes, sort of in a panic.
God. After only a week. That's incredible. Wow, so, I mean, without going into, all the possible agendas that could be behind a policy like that, it once again, it refers back to focused and unfocused awareness, because that would be a great way to prevent somebody from ever going into unfocused awareness. You can't even sleep. And then the rest of the time, you're constantly being observed and checked, and so you constantly have to be in an alert state as far as what are you communicating that might actually, be used against you.
Sure, like asking, one example of that would be, if you ask, even as someone who checked in voluntarily, if I were to ask, not say necessarily like, when can I leave, but if I were to mention something about leaving, I would get this weird sort of response like, well, we don't really like to talk about that, or something like that, which is pretty ominous if you think about it. It's sort of like saying, not just, we're not sure when you're going to leave and we don't want to talk about it with you, but also kind of implying, well, you may have just had some points deducted for asking about it.
Yeah, because if you want to leave, then that's an unhealthy indication somehow. There must be something wrong with this one. He wants to leave.
Well, and also, little things too, like it's you'd said if it was interesting that it happened after only a week, and to give you another little taste of something that could happen, you really are kind of infantilized in a weird way, like because people who come in, say like a shift changes after 8 hours or however long, don't really have much communication with the people who just left. So if I were to be, let's say the first day I got there, or something, and I were to talk to like a nurse who said, "Oh, here's how we generally do things here." There's actually no way for her to know how the other people think that they do things in general. I mean, they obviously have certain rules, that they all have to follow, but the culture of each staff member can actually be pretty different, and so you get a little bit of that kind of learned helplessness effect of, well, if I do something at one time, this happens, and then it could have the complete opposite effect at another time, And I could really see that a lot of those people were pretty far down that path because, I would look at their responses and it didn't make any sense when I first got there how they were acting, but it just seemed like they had been conditioned to be pretty helpless and not able to do a whole lot. Not all of them, but most of them seem to have a bit more experience with it than me. And not like, not to go with the idea that like I learned something from them, but I just noticed that their behavior really seemed to have been affected pretty profoundly by everything we were just talking about.
Sleep through these dreary months. mean, that's notorious as a form of bad parenting, or as an example of bad parenting, is if the child, I mean, never mind reward and punishment is a bad system to raise a child with anyway, I would say, but it's especially pernicious if the child gets rewarded and punished seemingly randomly. So there's actually no way that it can really develop behaviors based around, but it will continue to try. And to the extent that it tries and fails, it will simply give over all of its autonomy to the external, as in it will just constantly have to refer to external cues to know whether what it's doing is, I should say we, whether what we're doing is good or bad. And that's sure. Socialization, essentially, or at least that's the dark side of socialization, where you're completely dependent on the state to tell you what's good and bad.
Right, and on one level, I knew a lot of this while I was there, so there was also a lot of anger, but I mean, in a certain sense, I was angry with the staff, but I realized that in some cases they were ignorant or indifferent or, you know, just really, for some reason, you know, believed their own nonsense about it. I don't really know what most of them thought that they were doing, but I guess they just projected all of their shortcomings onto the patients there, like, oh, you know, of course this person is having trouble here because, you know, that's why they're here. They're someone that's troubled, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But so it wasn't like I was really angry at those people, but I became very angry while I was there. And while that didn't have an outlet at the time, it later, that's what led to me feeling like I should just cut off ties with my family and my girlfriend. And, you know, I probably wouldn't have gone there if they hadn't persuaded me. And I'm, yeah, completely forgive them now or don't blame them at all. But, you know, that's how that connection formed for me. Was it seemed really, you know, like a betrayal time.
And you wanted to cut off from, well, the agents of the betrayal, but from the external world entirely by going into the wilderness. So.
Right.
Did you tell your family about your experience in the way that you've talked about it here?
A little bit at a time. Mostly I would tell them, because it probably took me about 2 years to really be able to. So we're talking late 2014 for when the experience occurred, like October of 2014. It probably took me about 2 years before I could really talk about it how we're talking about it right now. And some of that had to do with some pretty good somatic therapy for trauma. But the way that I would talk about it before that was mostly in terms of like pain and loss. So particularly when I was experiencing a lot of what I consider to be, or at least did at the time, yeah, I think it's still a good framework, is what I considered to be PTSD symptoms at the time. You know, I would kind of narrate to my family and to that at the time girlfriend, who's my friend now, but we're no longer involved romantically. But I would say, you know, like, oh, you don't know how hard it was for me because, like, I can't even sleep now. Or, you know, I also had a lot of trouble eating. Like, I wasn't completely wasting away, but it really just disrupted my homeostasis enough that it was hard to even, it was hard to eat for a while. It was hard to, like, a lot of my drives were kind of off. Like, I had to make myself drink water. So it was really profoundly physically affecting to me and kind of out of anger, but also in seeking sympathy and, you know, to try to make sure that they understood what had happened to me. I would tell them about that, but it was usually precipitated by like an ongoing experience. It wasn't like I just, you know, shared this fully kind of processed retrospective with them or anything like that.
And this would have been the period, well, you say it was taking us a long period, actually, because you're saying it took you 2 years to recover, but were you in the period immediately after the wilderness, when you were still sort of with this cowboy altar? Were you trying to communicate with them about it during that period as well?
Yeah, it was.
Because you said that they thought, even after the institution, because of your strange behavior, they still thought you were unstable.
Absolutely, yeah, for a while.
Were they trying to tell you should go back?
No, thankfully they definitely listened. I'm not sure if they maybe thought that secretly, or maybe they thought, oh, maybe there's a better type of institution for this type of thing, but they for a while they had some doubts about my ability to take care of myself, which were mainly based on the idea that I had some kind of condition that would deteriorate over time. But I mean, I told them repeatedly. I said, I really think that this was mostly sort of brought on by poor lifestyle and drugs, and I implied, I'm not sure if I stated it outright, that I needed to recover from the trauma. And then, so as I became more aware of, trauma as a life event and what that looks like, I realized that most of what I was dealing with after a certain point was trauma related. And once I was able to articulate that, they really got on the same page with me and were better able to support me. Once I found the right language, by like looking into trauma and how people talk about trauma, and recovery from trauma, that was what really brought them into being more supportive in a way that I needed. I mean, they had tried to be supportive right from the beginning. They're actually very loving and concerned people and really smart and open-minded. And so, I mean, I can only imagine what some people go through when they don't have that at all in their family, but they were definitely misinformed or underinformed about trauma, and they were kind of buying overly into a, sort of a DSM model, like psychiatry model. And so once they got on board about what trauma is and how people respond to it and how it's possible to recover, I mean, especially from acute traumas. So no, they didn't really want me to go back. In fact, they definitely understood that it would be, really not something that I would be okay with. And because my behavior improved, I think I mean, not my behavior, but my like compared to what was most alarming to them, and most concerning, those things were no longer occurring. So it was mostly just my functioning was greatly diminished, and I really vehemently told them that it would not help to go back, and that I just needed time and support. And so they definitely got on board at that point with what I needed, or what I told them that I needed.
So, I mean, the thing I wanted to end on, because we have to end pretty soon anyway, was the cowboy, because I think there's various different ways in which that's really central to our conversation. So that was the part of you that came forth to take care of you in some way. It sounds as though the way you've described it, whether it was effective or not, I don't know, but in any event, it seemed like it was needed, so that would mean it was effective to whatever degree. So, I wanted to just ask you about the cowboy, right? I mean, I guess you didn't name him, but you did describe him as an altar in your notes, so I don't feel like I'm leading the witness too much here. That seems to be how you chose to interpret that part of you, as a kind of semi-consciously summoned altar. So, can you describe the cowboy, as in what he's like, or what it was like being him?
Sure. Well, there was a huge element of intuition to it, because it was like I won't really say willfully or intentionally, but I did consciously allow my everyday persona to take a back seat. So there was still that sense of observing, but I would, like, for instance, during a social interaction, I would, sort of just become passive, and these altered behaviors that were not the norm for me would come forward. And it's not like I felt completely out of control, but it was definitely like a surrendering control to this alternate persona or this alter. And so I would wear sort of like work clothes. About 70 or 80% of it was things that I already had, but I did get some cowboy boots and a couple different hats. And the area that I'm in, it's not totally unusual to see people that might dress like that or behave in that way. So I started going to some different places that I wouldn't have necessarily gone to before. Not that I would have avoided them. It just wouldn't have occurred to me to go to these other places.
Like bars and things?
Yeah, like certain types of bars, for example. So, yeah, different kinds of bars. And my voice totally changed. I don't feel comfortable doing an impression, but and the other thing is, like, I didn't really have an off switch for that. I didn't really have a way to stop with the different voice, and so my family was pretty alarmed by that.
It was a deeper voice, you said.
Well, just more accented.
Like what?
My voice.
What accent?
Like kind of a southern or almost like Texas type of accent.
Do you have any ancestors from that part?
That's a good question. No, I don't think so. I do have plenty of southern ancestors, though. And you'll enjoy this. It's a little bit tangential, but I actually have a great-grandfather who was a 33rd degree Mason.
Is he one of the southern ancestors?
Yes.
Okay, well, we'll file that one, bookmark that one for... anyways, so the cowboy, what do you mean by behaviors, though, beside going to bars? What other behaviors were you conducting?
Well, we talked about being outside a lot, and, you know, I thought I would get some sort of manual labor or not really like a blue-collar job, but some sort of outdoors job. You know, if that had continued, if that persona had continued, I'm sure I would have done that. Because,
Okay. Go ahead. I was going to say, did it come and go, or was it consistent while you were in it?
It's like 98% consistent. Once or twice, someone said, like, you're kind of freaking me out talking like that. Could you talk to me, like, in a more normal way? And I was able to do that a couple times, but other times I didn't seem to be able to.
Gosh. And what about from the inside? Like, what was it like being in that persona from the inside?
Sometimes there was a real sense of grief, like the person that I was the person I was formerly was no longer available to me. So I would grieve internally over that. And other times, other times it felt secure. Like, I definitely agree with what you said about that persona or that character taking care of me. So other times it felt safe and secure. Definitely. It was all pretty bizarre. I mean, I don't know if I really thought it was bizarre at the time, but it was pretty bizarre because, I mean, it obviously sounds really bizarre, but it was pretty bizarre because just the way that it flowed and happened, and it wasn't volitional, really. It wasn't something that I just thought would be a good idea, and it was so automatic. And at the same time, it was really... it was really a tangible experience. You know, it was something that really happened, but I never really felt a need to validate it, but I could see that if I had felt the need to validate it, it probably could have turned into some sort of crucial fiction, if I'm not misusing that term.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I mean, I don't know about the whole possession thing, and there could be something to that, but I'm not like drawn to that explanation as a way to validate it and make other people believe that something was really there, which is what I would understand a crucial fiction to be, you know, something to validate.
Yeah, although that would also invalidate it in terms of it being a viable, you know, future option for you, if you see what I mean. It would make it negative. I mean, that doesn't necessarily invalidate it. It makes it real, or even more real. But you could also have gone for like a past life, in, you know, I don't know, you could have spiritualized it in a way that would have made it positive as well. It might have even been more crucial.
Actually, now that you mention it, I was at the time, I hadn't thought about this, but I was actually, I don't know if you know this, but there's actually a lot of country music that has almost like a spiritual, there's one song in particular. Oh, so it's, the other thing was too, I would listen to a certain amount of country music, but not really newer country music. So most of it's actually, I think, pretty listenable. I don't really have a problem if one of these types of things comes on the radio now. So it'd be like Hank Williams or Waylon Jennings or people like that, sort of outlaw country or classic country. I was listening to a lot of that, and a certain amount of that actually has some theme of, if not like ancestor, certainly not ancestor possession, but there's one song that I can't think of the name of right now, but it's like a, it's a Johnny Cash song with some other people, and it actually talks about, it sort of hints at reincarnation. And so I was actually a little bit drawn to the past life explanation at the time, although not consciously. I just thought, I think it just made a lot of sense on some kind of intuitive level, but I never went the extra mile and tried to articulate that or really bought into it.
And was,
on a conscious level.
Was your mood different as in this persona?
Yeah, it was much more, trying to think of the right word. It was much more, I don't really want to say stable, but definitely much more stoic.
And have you, I mean, it sounds like it came on quite rapidly, rapid onset cowboy syndrome.
Yeah.
And did it pass rapidly, or was that more gradual?
I think it kind of had two phases to passing away. I think one phase was it loosened up a little bit, and at that point I was still reluctant to articulate or to maybe admit to myself that it was something that was, you know, really abnormal and quite bizarre, because there was some embarrassment. So I think that I had hoped, maybe on some level, that, yeah, this is very sort of image oriented, but I think on some level I had hoped that it would be integrated into my persona rather than just pass away. Or I should say be integrated into my identity rather than pass completely away. So there was that loosening that I noticed, which I do think probably correlated with me starting to smoke pot again. And then there was a time when I was just like, okay, I don't want any of this cowboy stuff anymore. It's really weird to me. So there was a time when I looked at it and just said, like, this is so strange.
So then you consciously rejected or disowned the behaviors, and
yeah.
Did you get rid of the hat and the cowboy boots?
I did. I mean, at one point I put them in a closet, and later I actually got rid of them.
Too bad. I was going to suggest that you try them on and see what happens.
I might still have something. I might still have something from all that, but I will say that. I will say that there was definitely a really powerful effect from the costuming and the, the physical, almost kind of prop aspect of it. Definitely was a huge part of it.
Did you ever talk to this character as someone outside of yourself?
I can't say for sure that I did, but it feels like something that could happen, you know?
Yeah, what would you say if you were going to say something to him?
It's a really good question. I'm not sure.
Would you want to thank him?
Yeah, that would be a good idea. I was kind of trying to think of questions I might want to ask or things like that, but I feel like I would already kind of know the answer. The answer would just be coming from me at that point. But yeah, something like thanking or yeah, something along the lines of being grateful or life is strange or something like that.
Sounds like a line in a David Lynch movie. Think it is a line in a David Lynch movie.
Isn't
I think it's the world. It's a strange world, I think is the line. Well, it's very evocative anyway. I mean, I feel like we could actually talk a lot more about this and but I'm glad we got it in at the end because I think it's actually a very compelling experience, and I just passed over it in the notes. I mean, I noticed it, but I didn't think about how significant it was until we actually got to it, and because it coincided with my cowboy fool thing, of course.
Right. I didn't even use the word cowboy in the notes,
Right.
for whatever reason. I think I felt like that was a level, a higher level of detail than I wanted to get into in the notes on a lot of things. There's like a lot of these things are kind of weirdly fractal like that. Like, you go pretty deep on all of them, but they're not all that compelling.
Right, as the cowboy, yeah. Did you have a name for him before this?
There was a time or two that like, I mean, I would just use my normal name, for the most part. It seemed to make the most sense. There was like a time or two that I didn't feel comfortable using my real name, so I used the name Chris just one or two times, just because it was a common. Well, my rationalization for why that is because it was a common name in the area, so it wouldn't have stuck out.
You mean you would introduce yourself as Chris
Yep.
in these bars that you wouldn't normally go to?
Yeah, I'd say I only did that like two or three times. For the most part, I use my normal name, my real name.
Everyone's lining up for a brand new pickup truck.
Have you seen Fight Club?
Not in a long time. I have seen it though.
Yeah. Well, you might not want to see it again, but it certainly brought. It came to mind when you took it back. The image of you going to bars in this altar, introducing yourself by its different name.
I need a history. I need history and the oil rush is falling down like rain, falling down like rain on all of us. The devil into your heart, you will never be alone. There's no time to stand apart. your new prairie home. And the Calgary Tower is shining in the night like a giant fist raised up with all its might. And the Calgary shining in the night like the mast of a ghost ship on its inaugural flight. It says my heart is a piece of garbage. My heart is a piece of garbage. My heart is a piece of garbage. Fight. Seagulls fight.